Hi, I'm Charlie, and this is Stereo Hysteria. Our October Artist of the Month, Paul Collins, started out playing drums in the influential yet obscure trio The Nerves, before finding popularity as the frontman for The Beat, whose 1979 self-titled debut album is still one of the best power pop albums ever recorded. More recently, he's cemented his status as an elder statesman of DIY rock and roll by tirelessly touring and networking with younger bands. His excellent new album, Feel the Noise, came out just last month, and I spoke to Paul over the phone on the Tuesday morning it was released, as he sat by the banks of the Hudson River. We'll be hearing that conversation over the next hour, along with music from throughout his career, starting with this performance of one of The Beat's biggest hits, recorded live in Europe, called Rock and Roll Girl.
I went down to check out the local disco show. I saw the people dancing on the floor. I wish there was a new way. Hey, hey, now it's a girl to say. Anybody dance, this is what I say. I wanna be with a rock and roll girl. I wanna be with a rock and roll girl. I wanna be with a rock and roll girl.
Hi, Paul. This is Charlie.
Hi. How are you, man?
I'm good. How are you?
Real good. I'm actually sitting on the Hudson River right now.
Excellent. Hopefully it inspires a good interview.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty excited. Today is the day my album drops, as they say in the business.
You recorded that in Detroit with Jim Diamond.
Yeah, it's my second record I made with him, and I really like working with him. He really knows how to make good-sounding records quickly, which is the name of the game these days.
And it has a very old-school vibe. Did you do it all to tape?
Yeah, that's the cool thing. Unfortunately, this is one of the last records that will be made in that studio because, I don't know, I think they sold the building or something, and he has to move his operation to another place.
Mm. Is this ghetto recorders?
Yeah, the gear he has is fantastic. And it's also the style he records in. This record actually was completely different from the last record in the terms of how we actually did it, but the vibe was the same, which is pretty much you go in and you just kind of do it, and you do what you want when you want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But this one, what I did is I just cut the record myself live to tape, you know, my guitar and my voice to a clip track, and then all the instruments were put on after the fact, which was really cool because I was able to give a performance, and I didn't have to wind up playing the songs 15,000 times.
Right. So it has that initial spontaneity to it?
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes records, every record is different. And for me, they're kind of traumatic because there's always a lot of pressure.
Right.
Either you put it on yourself or just in general, you know, because a record's a record. Once it's done, it's out there, and you're going to have to live with it for the rest of your life. So, plus, being such a big fan of music and records, I mean, that's the records is kind of like the Holy Grail. It's like, you know, we used to listen to those records and go, oh, my God, how do they get that sound? And so it's very important, and obviously the song selection and, you know, all the stuff that goes into making a record. And this one just kind of popped at the last minute. I was really pretty insecure about the material. There were like three or four aborted attempts because I didn't feel like I was ready with the songs yet. And then we did a recording in Europe that bottomed out. And, you know, it was like either this is going to happen or it's going to go over a cliff. Sure. And we pulled it out of the bag. And I'm really, really very happy and excited. And each record has its thing, you know what I mean? The thing that makes it special to you. And this one definitely was like pulling it out of the bag.
All that hard work paid off because I really enjoyed it.
Well, I'm very happy. And yeah, so far the response has been great. And, you know, when for someone like me who's been around for a while, let's say, and, you know, you have other records, so obviously people compare, you know, your current work to your older work, and is it better, is it as good, or, you know, have you lost it, or do you still have it? I'm always happy when people enjoy it, because that's what it's about. It's about enjoyment.
Now, let's go back to the beginning of your musical development. You are a native New Yorker?
I was born here. I kind of grew up all over the place, because my mom was a very bohemian artist, and she took me and my two sisters and brother kind of all over the world. We kind of bounced around all over the place. But then we eventually wound up back here, and I graduated from high school in New Jersey and moved directly into New York for a year. And then I went to California, and that's where I started my career in bands. I think my involvement in music began when I was a kid in Long Island listening to WABC radio and all the golden hits of that time period, which was, it made a pretty strong impact on me. The craftsmanship of songwriting and arranging and that whole thing, it's incredible. And there's no end to it. I don't ever feel like, I got this down, you know, this piece of cake. I know everything about this subject. Not at all. I'm always learning about it, and it's always so challenging. And it's always, like, so rewarding when you discover the secrets that are involved. And to me, it's very, very exciting.
Here's the lead-off track from the Paul Collins Beats 2008 album, Ribbon of Gold, called Hey DJ.
I said, hey DJ, play that song for me.
Been both a drummer and a guitar player in bands. Which one came first?
I started with the drums, and the reason why I started with the drums when I was a kid, I really didn't have any formal musical education. And I literally started playing with pencils. And I said, well, I can do this. You know, I don't need to know how to read music or anything to do this. And my first drum set actually was made out of kitchen. I had the old, remember the trash can with the step-on lid, you know?
Yeah.
That was kind of like my hi-hat bass drum. And pops and bands and stuff like that. And I remember my parents figured, okay, I guess this kid wants to play drums. So they bought me a Remo snare for Christmas one year, which I broke the head, I think, in about 20 seconds of playing. But, yeah, I started with the drums, and then I studied for a while in New York with an amazing drum teacher, Sam Ulano. And he's the one who kind of said, you know, I said, you know, I want to play rock and roll, and I want to be in a band. And he said, listen, man, if you want to do that, you got to go to the West Coast. And he was the one, really, that directed me to go to California. And I took his advice, and I went. And that's kind of where my career in music started, because I met up, literally on the third day I was there, I met Jack Lee, and then subsequently Peter Case, and we formed The Nerves, and, you know, the rest took off from there.
What was the reaction to The Nerves? Because it seems like you were doing a very specific kind of music that there wasn't really a scene around.
There was no scene around it, and there was no reaction except of, get out of here. That was the reaction. In fact, one guy said, this is not music, as he was throwing us out of the club. It was a very hard time to do that. Now, whether that was a blessing or a curse, I don't know. Emotionally, it was very difficult, because we were constantly basically being told, you know, to get out, and that we weren't any good. And, you know, we really believed in ourselves. So in a way, the adversity made us stronger and made us more committed to what we were doing. In fact, all we needed to hear was no from somebody, or you can't do that. And it was like, okay, that's what we're going to do. You can't make a record. Okay, we're going to make a record. You can't go on tour. Okay, we're going on tour. So it was kind of funny, and it forced us to do things that were above and beyond the call of duty, let's say. And the other thing is, we were so isolated. We were not from California. We had no support group. We had no friends. I mean, we were literally operating in a complete 100% vacuum. I mean, we would go for months, not days, months and months on end without even seeing people. You know, you go out on the street, there were no young people at that time. I mean, it was bizarre when I think about it. We didn't see young people our age, literally. We didn't see them anywhere. So the people we saw were the average, you know, working people in San Francisco who were going back and forth from their jobs, who were a good 10, 15, 20, 30 years older than us. But we were not tapped into any kind of youth culture at all. In fact, I remember when we left San Francisco to go to L.A., because we had just, like, figured that there's just no way we're ever going to get anywhere in this town, because there's no place to get to. It dawned on us that L.A. was the music capital of the world. We left the night, the very night the Mabuhay Gardens put on their first show. So we left the evening that things started to change.
From The Nerves' self-titled 1976 EP, the only music they released in their short career, there's a song that Paul wrote called Working Too Hard.
I'm working too hard, working too hard. Be the kind of man that you want. I'm working too hard, working too hard. Please you and your friends, you don't need me now. So why don't you say goodbye to me? You know you never try. Why don't you say goodbye? You know you never try.
Kind of one of those bands that, like,
fans of really obscure music go nuts about, because you only put out one EP with four songs, but all of those four songs are kind of now power pop classics. Why was that band so short-lived? Was it like a case of too many cooks?
No, I just think that, and it, you know, it was for me, because I was the youngest of the group.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, when I heard Hanging on the Telephone in a tenement flop house in San Francisco, Jack played me the acetate, which blew my mind. He actually had an acetate, a record, a black vinyl record of the demo, which I was like, oh my God, this is unbelievable. But when he played me that, I just said, this is it. We're going to be as big as the Beatles. No doubt in my mind. I'm serious. You know, I'm 17, 18 years old and stars in my eyes and everything. But I'm going like, this is the shit. It doesn't get any better than this. I had goosebumps running up and down my arms. And I couldn't believe my good fortune to, like, you know, waltz into this scene. I mean, Jack really, his understanding of the pop songwriting idiom was just unbelievable. I mean, you know, and Hanging on the Telephone was technically. There was nothing left to chance. Mm-hmm. Every millisecond of the song was accounted for. There was no slop. I mean, he was like, every comma, every pause, every iota had to be gone over and accounted for. And that, you know, some people say, oh, that's crazy, man. That's anal, man. Yeah? Well, you're listening to that record 40 years later.
Yeah.
A band made an EP with four songs on it.
When Blondie covered it, they really didn't change anything.
Blondie covered it and didn't change anything. Def Leppard covered it and didn't change anything.
Why mess with perfection?
Actually, what do they call it? Something is the form of flattery.
Imitation?
Yes, imitation is a form of flattery. Yeah, I think that that showed how well constructed the song was, that they thought highly enough of the licks and stuff that they would want to do it, because there's many versions of songs where they just take the melody and they basically, you know, revamp it.
And here's the Nerves' original version of the Jack Lee composition, Hanging on the Telephone.
I'm in the phone booth, there's the one across the hall.
Did everything humanly possible that three young men could do, and nothing happened. And it just kind of died on the vine. It was like, you know, a plant with no water.
Mm.
We could not get any encouragement from anybody. So it fell apart.
And after that breakup, you and Peter Case formed the Breakaways, which was even more short-lived and obscure than the Nerves.
Yeah, that was like so, for me, it was like, I really felt like my arms got cut off. I mean, these guys were like my brothers, and I would have followed those guys into hell. And we did. We went to hell. But that was like, you know, what are we going to do? We can't give up. And you got to understand, the panorama at that point in time was so dismal. It was like we were in L.A., and like we had done everything we could do. We thought we were on the verge of, like, you know, going to be big stars, and here we were back on the street again and no money, and it was like, this is just fucked. So So we tried to do that, and that, admittedly, that was like a defeatist move, you know. We just tried to keep moving, keep going, and it was pretty pitiful in terms of, like, you know, there were no gigs, there was nothing to do. And then Peter just, you know, and I understand, Peter was like, you know, I'm going to do my own thing, man. I got to do my own thing. And he was older than me, he was a much more proficient songwriter than me, and he was, you know, more seasoned. He had been out on the road doing his own thing, so this was like my first real band, and I still was like, you know, clutching onto the skirt, clutching onto the, you know what I mean? I was not ready to stand on my own 2 feet, which I subsequently did with the Beat, and I was very lucky to meet Steve Huff, who kind of replaced Jack and Peter in the sense that he was so knowledgeable musically. He was like my foil in terms of continuing.
Up next, we'll hear the title track of a compilation of Postnerve's pre-Beat recordings made under the name The Breakaways, called Walking Out on Love.
Oh, wow.
One song of yours that was performed by The Nerves, The Breakaways, and The Beat is Walking Out on Love.
And Green Day.
And The Exploding Hearts. I first heard it from The Exploding Hearts.
Yes. You know, it's funny, and I'm sure every artist or songwriter will tell you that sometimes the song that, for some reason, is the most popular is the one that you would least expect yourself as a writer. I mean, not that I don't like Walking Out on Love. I love Walking Out on Love. But it's surprising that that's the song that, I mean, it's been covered by God knows how many bands. It would be great if someone like Green Day actually recorded it, because obviously, financially, a real boom. But it came close. They played it on Broadway many, many times as the encore in their American Idiot. But yeah, that's the song. I guess the thing that people like about that song is it's so simple,
right?
And it rocks so hard. I fell on that. That's, I think, my forte. And Working Too Hard is like that. I fell on that, like, how to put together, like, and that's because of my inexperience. You know, it's so simple, but it's got that little teeny twist. You know, you go to the B, and it's like, oh, damn. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That is cool.
When the Beat put out their first album, you had CBS Records behind you, and it was like a major label proposition.
Well, we didn't know how good we had it.
What did you learn
kids,
from that?
Like, I learned that the music business is a very, very tough, cutthroat business. I learned that when you start doing it for the business, you might as well just hang it up, because it's all going to go south. The best thing to do is to stay true to your art, to do it because you love it, and just stay right there and let the rest happen. And if you make $1 million, that's great. If you don't, that's cool too.
From the self-titled 1979 debut album of The Beat, here's a rockin' song called USA.
Place that
hop kind of existed throughout the 70s, but it wasn't like until the late 70s that it became a genre that was known and marketable, and the first Beat album came out right in the middle of that. Did you consider yourself a power pop band or just like a rock and roll band?
No, in fact, the first time we heard that word, we puked. We're like, power pop? Get out of here, man. We're not power pop. That sounds like a real wimpy journalist term to kind of like screw us. You know, like, we're never going to get on the radio now, boys. So, no, power pop initially in the industry, you got to understand too. I mean, flashback, the United States of America, in the mid to late 70s, the music industry, there is no DIY scene. There is no independent label scene at all. It's all major labels. It's all ivory towers. All the album covers are airbrushed into perfection. I mean, you know what I mean? That is the environment that we're in. And then all of a sudden, you got the Sex Pistols and the Ramones and the Dead Boys and television. But, you know, you got this bubbling under of like, okay, there's a new current coming out. You know what I mean? There's a new thing. And, of course, all these bands were on major labels. And the labels were like, you know, how are we going to make money out of this? And then there's radio, and that was the big thing. Like, how are we going to get, because radio drives this business, especially then. So radio was the engine. It had to get on radio. If it wasn't on radio, it wasn't going to sell platinum, and that's all the big companies were interested in.
Yeah.
So program directors were like, power pop? You got to be kidding me. New wave? Punk rock? Forget it. I mean, Sheena's a punk rocker, probably would have been a number one hit single if the word punk rocker wasn't in the title, and they had marketed it differently, because it was a stone-cold hit single. I mean, come on. It's like, maybe it would have missed, but man, it would have been tough. So, no, it pigeonholed us. We didn't like it. Now, flash forward 20 years, power pop as a genre is an established idiom now. It is a legitimate language of rock and roll. It survived two generations of people now. You have young groups that are still carrying the torch, that use it as a musical reference, that embrace it. So now it means something completely different. Now it's like, oh, have you heard power pop? Oh, it's this cool subgenre, man. Like, you know, you got to get into it. Like, you know, if you really think you know about music, you got to know about power pop. And to me, because I do this all the time, people say, what is power pop? Power pop embraces the best elements of rock and roll. Great melodies, great songs, great guitar hooks, and harmonies.
Mm-hmm.
That's in almost every single great rock and roll song that I know of. And it is not by The Who. And it is not by the Raspberries. Those guys did not play power pop. Power pop was born by musicians who were born in the mid to late 50s and started making records in the mid to late 70s, period, as far as I'm concerned. Not that those things didn't influence us. If you want to say that, then every pop band is power pop. The Beatles are power pop. Mm-hmm. I mean, but they're not. They played, you know, rock and roll. They weren't making power pop, you know, 2 minutes. Some of their songs are short, but you know what I mean? Power pop was a reaction to what was going on in the 70s.
Right.
All these, like, 15-minute guitar solos, these hair bands, and, you know, all this shit, you know, Hotel California. Not that those things are bad, but at the time, we were dead set against that shit.
Yeah.
Because it was old. I mean, and just like, you know, then grunge came along, and then rap, and then hardcore punk, or, you know what I mean? It's all reactionary. Like, what's happening? Well, we hate that shit, so let's do something different.
Up next, we'll hear the title track to Paul's 2010 solo album, Kings of Power Pop.
A long time ago, all across this land, rock and roll was hurting, it was feeling so bad. A couple of boys picked up their guitars, they couldn't really play, so they started writing songs. They were the kings of power pop. At first it wasn't easy, cause no one really cared. They kicked them out of everywhere, they kicked them down the stairs. Standing on the corner of Hollywood and Vine, listening to the man tell me rock and roll had died. They were the kings of power pop. It used to be so hard, eating beans and sleeping in cars. Turn the radio on, make you wanna scream. Then I heard the Ramones, rock and roll radio. My daddy, I still play my guitar, try to get it up to be a rock and roll star. Sometimes people, they remember me and tell me how great they thought I used to be. They were the kings of power.
thought we'd go very far. But I got Friday on my mind. I wish I were the Beatles or the Rolling Stones. Anything but to be sitting here alone. Some of us got lucky, some of us got fame. Some of us are standing here with one foot in the grave. We were the kings of power pop. We were the kings of power, the kings of power.
But now we live in a time, it's kind of different. I mean, I'm not making a value judgment, because the information highway with the internet is so massive that there isn't, like, what is happening today? I mean, what is, you know, thank God. I mean, you know, because when I was alive during the grunge period, and grunge obliterated everything, yeah. Everything. There was no blues. There was no jazz. It was like, you know, the United States was like a frickin' horse with blinders on, like grunge, 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 grunge. Like, come on, man. I mean, not that that's bad, but not to the point where everything else becomes extinct.
Right.
So now, I think because of the internet, because kids have access to everything, because they don't have to eat the crap that the corporate world puts out exclusively, you know, you can find all this subculture stuff, you can find stuff. And that really works big for me, because I am definitely a below-the-radar artist. And I play exclusively with up-and-coming bands, and all these kids know my music, and it always blows me away, because, I mean, literally, I'm looking at some guy or some girl liking a song of mine that was written a good 10 years before they were born. That's pretty heavy.
I think that the internet has sort of, like, leveled it out, so with something like Spotify, you could listen to any song ever made.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you can't get paid for it, but, yeah.
That's a different story.
But yes, I mean, I think it's wonderful in the sense of, if you want something, you can find it. Mm-hmm. And I'm always impressed with how well-versed the young people are, not just with my music. I mean, you know, I see kids, they're listening to Frank Sinatra, and I'm going, how do you know about this? Oh, you know, this cool stuff, I like it. There's all these kind of weird things, like sometimes it's a commercial that brings back some great old music.
Yeah.
Like my kid knows these songs, I say, how did you hear that? Oh, it's in the new Nike commercial. So I go, okay, no, I don't like Nike. They hate commercials, but yeah, I think it's cool that this 40-year-old song, my kid's digging on it.
You've been really busy lately.
I'm working more now than I did when I got signed by CBS in 1979.
You spent most of June touring America. You went to China. You'll be on the road from September till November. Being on the road for that long, how do you keep healthy and sane?
Very simple. I have a very simple motto. I eat right and I sleep right. I don't party, I don't do drugs, I quit smoking, I don't drink when I'm working. If I've got the night off, I'll have wine with dinner because I love wine. Mm-hmm. But I keep it simple. I go there, I do my thing, I go to bed as soon as I can, I eat good food, and I enjoy it, and I'm in the present. You know, and it's different, like I did all the party stuff, and that's great, but man, you cannot do that every night. You just can't, not at my age. Something's going to give. And what happens when you do all that stuff, and it's great, and I'm not telling anybody what they should do, because Lord knows I did it all, is when you stop doing it, it's like you're in the here and now, and it's like, oh, this is cool, you know, you're in the present, you're not freaking out, you know what I mean?
Featuring lead guitar work by Cyril Jordan of the Flame and Groovies, here's a track from Paul's self-titled 1992 solo album called Fall on You. Wow!
Was it me?
Yes, I know it's
she tell you that maybe she'd be happier with someone new. Yeah, and all the time you worried about the pain that's gonna fall on you. Forgot to make the payment, so they're gonna disconnect your
there's a whole bunch of your career that seems to be sort of unchartered. Like, I've read that in the 90s you kind of did a move away from power pop and released a couple, like, Americana country rock type records, but I can't find them anywhere. Are there any plans to put those back in print?
You know, the 90s was a real bust for me. I mean, we already talked about grunge. I couldn't get anywhere with my music. I was completely washed up in the 90s. I put out a couple of records, one From Town to Town, which is a beautiful little record. And then what else did I put out? I put out the One Night album and the Paul Collins album, which are hard to find. Yeah, there are plans eventually to get them out. There's so good music on it. It was just a very, I mean, when I think about that time and I think about what is going on today, if I had known that then, I would have been able to hold on a little better, because I really thought I was completely 100% washed up, and that was it, that the whole thing was over, and that I would never be doing what I am doing today. And it was sad, and it was hard. Well, I had a kid, which was, I don't regret that, but I delivered newspapers, I delivered furniture, I was a messenger boy, I did whatever I could to put food on the table.
When did things start to turn around for you?
Things started to turn around for me in, well, at 9/11, funny because I'm standing right here looking at that same part of New York. I left New York. I moved back to Madrid. A friend of mine who had known since, a friend I met when I was moving into New York when I was 17 and had lost touch with for like, I don't know, 15 years and got back in touch with, who was a successful businessman, wanted to open up a bar with me in Madrid because he had heard about, you know, all the wonderful things they had told him about living there. So I went there and I did that, thinking it was going to be easy, and it was one of the hardest things I ever did. And we did that right around 2001. I did that for 2 years, worked myself to the bone, smoked, drank, and snorted my way into oblivion. And then the whole thing fell apart, and I didn't touch my guitar for 2 years. And in a certain way, it was a relief. You know, when you try to make it in the music business for many, many years, you start to kind of feel like a prostitute. You know, you just feel like do anything, like a $2 whore. And it was a relief not to have to do that, you know, to sell myself, because it's a personal thing. You know, you write your own songs and stuff. You're really putting your quote-unquote soul on the line, and if people don't like it, obviously, it's
like a personal rejection.
Yeah, it is. It's not like. It is, you know. So it was a relief not to do that anymore. And actually, the other reason why I put it down is I said, I'm done. I'm tapped out, man. I got nothing to say. It's done. Your records all are reasonably decent. You've got great songs on each one. Let it go. Walk away with some dignity and gracefully. And don't, you know, make a fool out of yourself. And then I picked up my guitar one day, and I was like, bam. I had the excitement back and the joie de vivre and songs and everything. I said, oh, my God, it's not over. I'm not done. Hallelujah. And that's when I made Flying High in my living room for no money, with three guys, and the production was four guys who love playing music with a bunch of simple songs, no production, just get it down to tape. After not having put out a record for 12 years. So that was like the beginning of the comeback trail. And I just worked it up back from there. That record is, even when you talk about records and stuff, that's a very special record for me. And it has some songs on it, one in particular, Helen, which I play every night now and have been for years. And a song that people adore as much as Rock and Roll Girl or Don't Wait Up or any other song I've ever written. They sing it at the shows. They dance around the room. They smile when I play it. And it is so rewarding to me, because it was at a time when I was like, you know, really trying to find out for myself and with the people that know my music if I had a reason to keep going.
From 2006's Flying High, here's that song, Helen.
If you do, then everything will be the way it ought to be. baby. Baby, if you put me down, I think I'll drown in all the tears I cry. Oh, don't you break my heart, Helen. Oh, baby, please don't start, Helen. Oh, no, don't break my heart. Oh, please don't break my heart.
Yeah, it's a lovely song, and it's one of those songs that when you write it and record it, you go, well, you know, this is nice. This isn't really a rock song, so, you know, probably people aren't going to do too much of it. And bam. That's what life is all about. Not a song I would have thought would command the kind of attention that that song gets. I mean, people call me up, they want the words because they want to sing it at their wedding. I mean, it's like, really? And I play that song. I mean, at the same time period, we went and played Austin, South by Southwest, the first time after being off the scene in America for 12 years. I mean, people literally thought I'd either died or become a doctor. Mm-hmm. And this kid is standing at this barbecue we're playing, and he's like, you know, fucked up, and he goes, hey, man, play that song, man. You know, I don't know, the one that tells you what life is supposed to be about. And I go, what? How do you know? This kid is like 18, mm-hmm. you know? How do you know this song? I mean, I'm surprised your mother would know this song. You know what I mean? And so, oh, I love that song, man. And that's when I realized, because I was at this show. We were invited to do a barbecue. And I'm standing there with all these 20-somethings, and I'm like 50 whatever. And they're all covered in tattoos and having the time of their life. And I'm standing there, and I'm going, why am I here? What are these people going to possibly see in me? I mean, this is nuts. I don't belong here. And I played, and they went crazy, and I realized that that's the power of music, and none of that other stuff mattered. Mm. And that was a big revelation for me, and a welcome one. And then I just said, okay, I have every right to do this as anybody else, and they dig what I'm doing, so fuck it.
Right, I did want to ask you about one song on the new album, which is actually a re-recording of a song from the Breakaways days, Little Susie.
Yeah.
What inspired you to revisit that song?
Little Susie was on the Breakaways. That wasn't really an official album. That was a collection of demos and outtakes. The Breakaways were a band that probably did maybe 8 live shows. Mm-hmm. I'm not kidding. So Little Susie, to me, was on the line. It was kind of legitimate. Now, had Little Susie been on the Beats' first album? No freaking way. You know, that was a legitimate album done with the producer, put out by the band. You know, I wouldn't re-record Rock and Roll Girl. But since it was on this Breakaways record, which was never put out in the first place at the time, you know what I mean? It was kind of just kind of collection. Mm-hmm. It was available. It was it could make it into the pool. And it was in the pool for quite a while, and it would go in and it would go out. And actually, right before I made the record, I was going, you know, fuck Little Susie, man. I'm 58 now. I did this song when I was 18. There's no fucking way. And I couldn't get it up to do it. I'd start to play it, and I'd go, come on, this is silly, man. I can't do this. I look like a jerk. It's like I felt like I was trying to put on my pants from when I was 18, and I mm-hmm. didn't fit into them. But I was going to try like hell to get that button to button. 2 days before, I went to Detroit, and I had the date set, and I was in a terrible state because up until 2 days before, I didn't know whether I had an album full of great songs.
Yeah.
But I couldn't keep putting it off. So I was like, okay, Colin, you know what the fuck you got to do. You got to make a fucking rock and roll album. Now cut the shit, get off the pot, and just fucking do it. I left out of my apartment with my guitar, and I pretended I was playing to this hot chick that I wanted to fuck. And I said, this is what I want to tell you, baby. And I just spilled it out, and Little Susie came out. And then, when I was up there, and I'm so happy it did, because I cut it, and then we were putting the drums on, and it was the last song to be done, and Dave Shetler was in the control room, and the drums were all set up, and the sticks were on the snare, and I said, hey, Dave, let me just show you what I used to play on this song, because I was a drummer. Mm-hmm. And I start playing, and all of a sudden, keep going, keep going, it's fucking awesome, man, keep going. So I cut the drums, and now that song has a whole special meaning to me.
And she laughed as I started to say, Little Susie, don't you go away. Little Susie, don't you go away.
did want to ask about one more song, Don't Know How to Treat a Lady, which was just on my first listen. That was the standout.
That's funny, because that was one of those songs that was like sometimes on, sometimes off. And even when we cut it, the producer said, no, do that song. I said, Jim, I'm not totally convinced about this song. He said, shut up. I got a plan for this song. And I said, okay, you got a plan. Somebody's got a plan. I'm not going to stop them. I'm trying to remember where I wrote. I wrote that song in Atlanta, and I was hanging out with Gentleman Jesse and Gentleman Jesse and his men. And that's the first band that ever played that song. And my good friend Warren, who is now the guitar player for the Barracudas, loved that song, and he had a really great solo for it. So it was one of those songs that was like kicking around, just like With a Girl Like You. With a Girl Like You was originally recorded as a single for Fat Possum, I don't know, I'm talking maybe 6 years ago, and I knew that was a great song, and I think it's a great song, and I think we finally nailed it. I love the recording. So that's Treat Her Like a Lady. That's what it's like. And then, you know, it wasn't like as a songwriter, I wouldn't go, this is the best song I ever wrote. But sometimes you don't know. And then that's why I get a kick out of it when somebody like you says, that was the standout song for me. I go, you know what? You never know.
Right. Never give up on a song.
No.
Probably still a spark in it.
Don't know how to treat a lady. Don't know how to treat a lady. Don't know how to treat a girl. If you wanna make her mine, well then hold her, don't hold her, 'cause that will take a time, and I'll show her I'll hold her. Everybody knows. Be cruel to her, just use her, 'cause I'll be standing by, and I'll hold her, console her. I'm gonna make her understand it's crazy that she's with you, man, because you don't know how to treat a lady. Don't know how to treat a lady. Don't know how to treat a girl. A girl. Don't know how to treat a lady. Don't know how to treat a lady. Don't know how to treat a girl.
Yeah, you recently started the Beat Army, sort of like a network that helps DIY rock bands book and promote themselves.
Well, yes and no. I started actually quite a while ago, and it was a move. Actually, what happened is I was talking to my record company. This is like 4 years ago, And I love the guy, but he's a realist, let's put it that way, extreme realist. And he's saying, look, man, you know, there's only 50 stores in America that sell this kind of music, you know, and he's painting the super realistic, you want to slit your throat picture about the state of the business for people who make music like I do. And I hang up with them, and, you know, I've been doing this for, at that time, 35 years, and I go, man, no way. I can't believe that. No, it can't be true. And there's got to be a way to polarize all these people that I know that say they love this kind of music and the thousands more that I know are out there. Mm-hmm. So that's why I started the Beat Army. And I kind of half-assedly keep it along. I try to encourage bands to post on it. It kind of does its thing. It's one of many blogs and Facebook pages. Some of them are a lot more actively worked at by the people who run them than my Beat Army page, because I've subsequently kind of moved on to the Beat Army tours, which really is where I'm at now, more than on the Facebook page, is I tour with all these bands, and I keep connecting them and keep connecting them and keep connecting them, and they keep meeting each other and subsequently going on tour with each other. And I've developed this whole network of bands, and now my new project is I'm going to do a tour in January on the West Coast, and it's going to be one step up. It's going to be like, instead of putting on a show, it's going to be putting on an event. Each show will start with a record fair, which will be the local record store that's into what we do, coming down with four or five tables. I got a woman who runs a vintage store in San Diego. She will reach out in each market to the local rock and roll vendors who do stuff that's kind of appropriate to the kind of music we play. And so there'll be like a fair. You know, it'll start, let's say, at 5 o'clock, so people will be in the club. We'll have some local bands do, like, acoustic performances, and then we'll have the traditional four-band show. But the idea is that when the first band goes on, there's people in the club.
Right.
Because that's always the big thing in a club. The first band doesn't want to play on time because there's nobody there yet, and who wants to play in front of nobody? And it's also a way to pull in all these different people. And I've gotten great reaction. Like one guy said, yeah, this is what we used to do. When we go to the show, we would come in the afternoon, we would go to record stores, we would buy records, and then we would go to the show. And that was kind of like our rock and roll day.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an attempt to kind of recreate that, make an event out of it, and polarize the people in the scene and create more networking possibilities. And what I've learned over the last, I don't know, since 2008, since I started doing this, it's all about networking. It's not necessarily where you go, it's who you know.
Right.
So that's my next project, and to keep polarizing this. Now, in today's world, I don't get really caught up on the whole aesthetic of whether you're power pop or not. I don't really give a fuck. Mm-hmm. If you're a young rock and roll band, and you use electric guitars, and you're trying to write songs that are reasonably melodic, and you're singing, let's go. What we need to do is we need to unify. We need to pool all these fan bases to make a legitimate fan base, whatever name you want to call it. You know, it's like what the whole world is going for. What are we going for? We're going for unifying. We're not going for a separatist thing. The global community, strength in numbers. Because what we do, really, at the end of the day, is about having fun. No big deal. It's just about having fun for us, ourselves, and for the people that we play for.
Mm.
And it's good. And we're getting good at it. And we play with all these young bands, and it's a nice generational thing. We keep it very real. There's no attitude. We're not rock and roll stars. We're just, you know, peeps out there playing music and having fun.
I have to say, it's been inspiring just to see on my Facebook feed bands that I've played with are playing with the Paul Collins Beat. Boss Mustangs from Kalamazoo have played with you a few times.
I love those guys. I wish they were more out there. I heard they broke up.
Really? I played with them last
December. Yeah, they are great. We loved them with their suits and everything. Yeah, that's the cool thing about what I'm doing now. I mean, it's a lot more fun, man. I mean, we play with these cool new up-and-coming bands. It's exciting. These guys are cool. And it's great discovering these new bands. And they're all over the place.
Well, good luck on the forthcoming tour and all the best with the new album.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the interview. And we'll see you out there.
And that's all the time we have for this week. I'd like to thank Paul for his time and encourage everyone to check out his new album and to see him play live the next time he comes to your town. Be sure to tune in again next week when our topic will be songs about happiness. This is Charlie, signing off.